My name is Christopher Joseph Layton. I was born November 16th, 1955. My father's name is Walter Matthew Layton, and my mother's name was Olga Marie Layton. I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. Corpus Christi was kind of a child's paradise. You know, there was the beach. I lived on the bay. It's a coastal town, coast of Texas. Went to the beach, kind of ran around like kids will do. So there was a lot of kid-like activities that you could engage in. It's a harbor city. It was also a naval air station post. So there was a lot of military and shipping. You know, the main commodities around there are maize, cotton, onions, and petroleum. So it's a harbor. It's a port city. And the way that has changed, I am not certain. I haven't been there in a little while. All my family is basically gone. I have one sister that's still alive, but the rest of my family is deceased at this point. So we were basically out of Corpus Christi now. Last time I was there, it kind of looked like a lot of other cities struggling in the American landscape. It never really was quite the hotbed of a cultural activity. It's a real working man's kind of place. Rough fishing, you know, shipping, farming, you know, good old hardworking American kind of stuff. I did spend time before I got to Austin. I spent half of my life in Corpus Christi, my childhood, and the other half in Mathis, Texas. It's a small farming community about 40 miles north of Corpus Christi. And it was about 4,000. When I left Corpus Christi, it was about 200,000 people. It's pretty much had a pretty stable population. Mathis, Texas was about 4,000 people, and it was a farming community. Yellow onions, Milo maize, and cotton were kind of why the town existed. So I spent half of my life there. I don't know, I think probably became interested in music when I heard the radio. You know, you heard music and went, wow, you know. It's hard to, and as a professional, I mean, that was later on, but, you know, the Beatles had come, and it would kind of overshadow the Elvis Presley thing, you know, at least in my perspective in childhood. And but I think what happened for me when I was really young, about 6 years old, I heard The Twist by Chubby Checker, and it kind of ignited something in me. And on that same day, there was a little thing where I got in trouble because I cut some oleander branches and started beating around on stuff, thinking I heard the drums, really kind of flipped my switch. And anyway, I got in trouble with my mother because I was, you know, they're poisonous and blah, blah, blah. My father went to the back closet and pulled out a bunch of 78s, bound 78s that were all big band music. And he played those for me for about 2 hours on that Sunday. And all of a sudden I was like, wow, what is this? That was, I think that was kind of what really got me, it was what made me aware of the music that I became most involved with later on. But that got my interest in generally more in music than just listening to the radio. You know, had two older sisters, everybody was buying records, and, you know, there was a record store that we would go to in Corpus Christi. We had a little listening booth, and you could listen to stuff. So that kind of, right after that, I kind of got really interested in the whole idea of music. Drums, my first and last instrument. I had a brief stint playing guitar to learn a guitar so I could try to write songs. But I've kind of dropped it. I have a pledge to get back to it. We'll see what happens with that. Yeah, the formal training that I had that started for me with playing drums was in intermediate band. Right about that same time, I played snare drum in the concert band and the marching band. And right about that same time, I had took an interest in playing a drum kit and had a friend of mine whose older brother had a set of drums that I rented from him. I had to go there to play him at his house, but, you know, that was so I was doing that also. But my formal training was in the school band. That's a good question. I don't know what the most challenging aspect. It's challenging today, on the basis that, you know, whether you're first learning or you're continuing to like expand your horizons and become a better musician or a player, that the challenge is always there. I have to say that as a child, you know, the wonderment and the sheer fun of doing that was kind of overrode the idea of like, oh God, I'm gonna have to work to learn how to do this. You know, I think those things happen as children, and we have fun doing things. We don't think, oh, this could be a long haul thing. So, you know, reading and, you know, in school, you know, in school band, to learn how to read and play and do both of those things at the same time, because there's a demand for, you know, efficiency of your performance is a challenge. You can't kind of just do whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. So that's a challenge. Well, I got a snare drum when I started in intermediate band, and I guess I was 11 years old then, intermediate band, and I got a drum kit when I was 15, my first drum kit. And I got that, I had a little paper route, I saved money, and parents matched it, and you know, that kind of thing, and went to a place called the Horn Shop in Corpus Christi and got my first drum kit, a little 1963 white Marine Pearl Ludwig downbeat kit, a little four-piece kit. And then I got real excited. You know, I was in school band, I went to junior high band. You know, I was in junior high band, and so I was doing both of those things and listening to a lot of records and new bands that were coming out and trying to imitate those drummers, and that was kind of probably the most of my self-education, you know, around the drum kit. I came to Austin, I moved to Austin December 18th in 1975. I got out of high school, and that summer my father passed away. I started at Del Mar College in Corpus Christi as a biology major with a music minor, but I was in school that year, and I looked around. I was working, you know, in the music scene, and it just seemed like it wasn't a place that something just told me that this wasn't a place where I could continue to live if I wanted to have a professional music career. And I had been to Austin in 1969 to visit my sister for 4 days, but she was at UT. It was the only other place that I knew. And I thought, God, that, I remember how much fun I had here. So one day I decided that I was just going to pack up and leave Corpus and come here. Collared, you know, got together some friends. I was just talking to one of them. We put together a little band and we ventured up here. Nobody had any money or anything. We barely got up here. And we took over an old abandoned house out in Manor, Texas. Some guys had abandoned. They still had 3 weeks worth of rent left on it. So we came up here and just started inhabiting that house and started figuring it all out. That was 75, yeah. I don't really call myself that, but other people do. It was given to me by Stevie Vaughn. It came from a kind of little wrestling match that me and a tour manager, rather the way I got the nickname Whipper, was in a Nacogdoches hotel room, and it was a wrestling match that me and the tour manager, road manager, had, in that something about the comment that I was a real whippersnapper, and Stevie kind of pulled Whipper out of that phrase, and every, you know, people I work with and friends have called me that ever since. It had nothing to do with a bunch of other stuff that people are certain that it has something to do with, but it's a nickname. The style of music I'm generally known for is blues, shuffles for some particular reason. I mean, I play other things, and I get called to do other things, but that's mostly how people identify me, is I'm kind of a blues rock and roll drummer. Well, we developed Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble, as it ended up being known. That was many years in the making. When Stevie passed away, I formed the band The Archangels and named it, so that was something that I got together with the other three members, which was a great band. Ended up being a very successful musical idea, as well as in many other ways. Co-formed the band Storyville, Archangels had me and Tommy Shannon, Charlie Sexton, and Doyle Bramhall too in it. And Storyville was me and Tommy Shannon, Malford Milligan, David Holt, and David Grissom was that band. Those are probably the three bands that were the longest parts of my career. I had a band briefly that I formed with a couple of guys from Canada, Ben Richardson and Gordy Johnson. It was called Grady for a few years. And then I've done a lot of other work with people as a recording drummer and touring with other people. But those have been the bands that I've had. Buddy Guy, Eric Johnson, Johnny Lang, Steve Vai, Joe Satriani in various forms, Larry Carlton, to name some. Zach Wilde. I've performed with Zach Wilde. I work, actually, most of these people that I named, I've worked with them somewhat regularly on an annual basis in the Experience Hendrix tour that I do. Been fortunate to do for the last 15 years. I think that every situation is a learning experience, in that I've been in situations where I learned what I never wanted to do again and what I maybe didn't want to be involved with. But mostly they've been ones that have been musically enriching, and that maybe making certain right decisions led to, you know, a confirmation that was the right thing to do. That's what I believe about just living life. Everything that we do is not like just the big successful, this is the big ticket thing, and so this was the cool thing, and all the other stuff I had no use for. I had to learn what is a bad decision and what's a good decision. What's the wrong thing to do? What's a right thing to do? So I look at all of them as learning situations. But the bands that I mentioned, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Double Trouble, the Archangels, Storyville, Grady, and the other things I've done have all been musically enriching, and they've all taught me a lot about a lot of things. For my standard of excellence or my criteria, what something I like is that when people, this is because I've spent more time in with this kind of philosophy in bands, is when it's an impromptu performance. We talk about live performance, and it's spontaneous, and it's everybody's really communicating musically, and that's, it feels like success in the moment of that performance. I mean, there's a lot of different standards you can use, but that's kind of probably the most profound one when I think about that question of what defines excellence. You know, are we doing this well together? Are we like in the moment together? And I think most of the bands I've been involved with had more of an improvisational aspect to them than to create one and then play it by rote. I think what makes somebody respected in your musical performance is, do they put their heart and soul into it? And of course, everybody wants like somebody who they think is really good at what they do. I think a hidden pairing of that with somebody who's a really good human being is a stellar combination. I'd hate people say, yeah, he's a really great drummer, but he sure is a real asshole. maybe somebody says about when those two things go well together, I think that that's highly respectable. You know, humanitarian, a great player. You know, takes time to pass along what maybe they've learned in their experiences or what they know about music to other people. I think that's to me, it's like the ultimate criteria of a respected musician. I might be in jail if I hadn't come here. If I had come to Austin. Now, it's a whole different world here. When I left Corpus Christi and I came here, my hunch and what I had witnessed my few years before I got here, I went, this place is really great. And there was so much, give and take of musical ideas and so many different kinds of people here playing music. It was just fascinating. There's no way that, I believe that about mostly anything though. you know, people who left and went and lived in Africa say, do you think you'd live the same kind of life if you hadn't left Corpus and gone to Africa for a decade? It's like, nah, I'd be pretty much doing the same old thing in Africa. You know, no, it's like, it's, these are the things I think that mold us. Yeah, this coming here was a life changer for me. I think my musical style was completely influenced by being here. I came here and I was interested in a lot of different kinds of music, but I'd kind of gotten on this thing of like jazz and funk, and that's when I came here. And then I saw Stevie Vaughn play, and I was just kind of mesmerized and enchanted by him, not because of the genre. People knew him as a blues guitar player. Mostly they think of Stevie, I think. But I was just fascinated with him as a musician and got to work with him. And so that was really a molding experience. And then I met a bunch of different people, his brother and a lot of different people that, you know, were in the blues world of music. And I think that my early experience with big band and my parents were big Ray Charles fans, and so we used to talk about how we saw this as the same, jazz and blues, and it seemed like the same kind of music to us. So I kind of found a whole different dimension that I wasn't really that aware of when I met him. So that was totally a complete forming of my, you know, my musical being, that whole 13 years of that experience. Venues that I played way back when, Antone's, which was down on 6th and Brazos. It was Soap Creek Saloon, which was out in Westlake, when it seemed like you were driving out into the country. Austin was a town of about 240,000 people back then. There was that, the Rome Inn, which was the corner of 29th and San Gabriel's, now Texas French Bread. There was the Continental Club, an earlier reopening of the Continental Club. And I did earlier gigs before I met Stevie. I actually worked with a guy named Dan Del Santo and his Professors of Pleasure. We used to play at a little house on 5th Street called Spellman's. A lot of folk artists, singer, songwriters, if you will. And yeah, there was a lot of passing the jug or passing the hat back then. That was one of my favorite places to play. I think one night we made $6 there. I mean, the whole band. But Austin had a number of different places like that, the Liberty Lunch, and played Raoul's a few times, the Longhorn, played on the East Side, played the place called First City. Most of these places don't exist any longer. I haven't actually played a show in an Austin club in a little while. I will. I'll be playing one in December, but at Antone's. But I've played the Continental Club most recently, and Sea Boys, you know, down on South Congress, or places that I would probably end up playing today. My first gig in Austin was at Castle Creek. It was on the corner of 15th and Lavaca. Became the Capital Oyster Bar, I think. I remember my very first night in Austin when I got here. I was in Manor, and someone said, hey, man, you know, the Electromagnets are playing at Castle Creek. I was like, Eric Johnson, the Electromagnets? We got to go. So we like dropped our bags and got in the car and went to the Stallion and got fried chicken and then went down to Castle Creek and saw the Electromagnets. My first gig was playing, opening for a band called Starcrossed, that played Castle Creek with them. And we had a band called La Paz, me and a guy, Sid Sanchez, Ricky Sanchez, and Fred Jarman. These all people had other bands later, but that was our little band. And we got this gig, we opened for them, and then we did a gig at Club Foot, which was another, it was down on 4th Street, just east of Congress. Those were like but that was my first gig here, first actual, just actually playing in a club. I think it's a wide open frontier. The music going forward, what the whole industry and people face these days. I think there's a lot of opportunity in that. You have to be even more creative. A lot of I think new structures are forming. You know, as I like to call them I call them inroads to, you know, these structures of our industry. But it's it's kind of the Wild West to a degree these days. It's more of a journeyman's occupation than I've ever known it to be. And that you get up every day and you go get what you earn by your effort that you put into it. I think when the digital evolution kind of pitched up, that it kind of blew apart all these old models, and it was kind of like kicking the top off an anthill, and everyone scrambled to go, how do I do this, and where do I go, and how do I get by? And there's a lot of things that grab for people's attention these days. Music, I think, has become more ingrained into those, even if it's in some ways it's more incidental than the main focus of. But I think it's a challenge. But I don't know if that's any real different than, say, you know, for somebody who was younger like I was, the challenges that I faced in my own unique situation. I mean, how things existed. So I don't know. Other than that, I'm not a fortune teller and I'm not a psychic, so who knows what'll really happen. Other than I think people will always want to listen to some music, and people will probably always be compelled to want to make it. I'm not an advice giver per se, but I think the one thing that's kind of, I think it's an ingredient for no matter what you do, is to persevere. If you find what your passion is, and music happens to be that, I think that perseverance is key to everything. People say, yeah, what do I need to do? You know, can you give me any tips? You know, can you give me phone numbers? Can you tell me, give me some people to talk to? And all that stuff is kind of part of the pathway that we all develop in our own life. But without perseverance, and without forging ahead, none of it really matters. And I think that probably the key thing is for anybody to find what really drives them. It doesn't even matter if it's music. Because some people say, well, I'd like to be a musician, but I don't know how good I'll be at it. I go, well, then don't do that. You know, because if you have big questions about everything that are keeping you from entering something, and that's understandable, that no matter what you do, if you can find that passion and you can persevere in that endeavor, that something will probably happen. I've been fortunate, I've been lucky, you know. It's not all about that, because I've had some things where my stars have been blessed. I go, wow, really? I got to do that, and this got to happen for me. But I've never stopped working. I've been doing this for almost 43 years. And I look around, I go, something's bound to happen in 43 years if you work hard and you try to make smart decisions and, you know, mind your P's and Q's and get in there. And I never got a trophy for quitting. I know that. No one said, hey, you just quit. Here's your trophy. And so we used to play Stevie Ray Vaughan. It was actually Stevie Vaughan and Double Trouble featuring Miss Lou Ann Barton on vocals. I said, that name is too long. It doesn't work on a marquee well. Anyway, we used to play the Rome Inn, and we did these Sunday nights there. And we played real loud. It was a real small place, and you know, we were just getting started, and we had so very little audience. Sometimes we had what we started dubbing. We started naming our pizza nights, where there'd be like five of us on stage, and we'd have like six in the audience. And so we'd go over to Conan Pizza. We'd call them up, and we'd get a couple of pizzas, and we'd have somebody bring them over. And when we'd take a break, we'd just put them on the front of the stage and invite the audience to eat our pizza with us. There was like 11 people total. So here, y'all want to come eat pizza? And then we all eat pizza, and then we get back up on stage and play some more. So we started calling those pizza nights. When it was like the audience number was so low that we could say, we can give y'all some of our pizza. I don't know why that came to me, but I do remember that Stevie and I were on the way to the original Stubbs Barbecue in Lubbock, Texas, and we were in his 65 Chrysler New Yorker, and we'd had a problem with the engine. It wasn't running well, so we stopped by W.C. Clark's house, because he was a really good mechanic, to see if he could get us on the road. And anyway, it kind of turned in this long thing where kind of got us mostly going, and then we took off, and we made that turn on 20 on 84 to head up to Lubbock, and we were really late. We were going to be like an hour and a half late, and then we had a flat, And I turned to Stevie. I said, well, let's put the spare on. He said, well, I don't have a spare. I said, you don't have another wheel? He goes, no, man. And I was looking, and the sun had gone down. It was now getting dark, and we were sitting out there, and I thought, what are we going to do? Anyway, we started pushing the tire. We took turns pushing the tire towards the show because we knew there wasn't anything back the other way by a number of miles. And I thought, you know, this is the end. I mean, this whole thing's blown. We needed the money. We were going to do a little 3-day stint at Stubbs Barbecue. And lo and behold, like an Edward Hopper painting, a little gas station. We saw a gas station with a light. It looked like about a half a mile off. And we were pushing the wheel, and we were all dirty and sweaty. And the guy was just backing out. It looked like he was locking the door. And anyway, I ran ahead. Stevie kept pushing the wheel, and I yelled, screamed. And he fixed the tire and put us in the tire in his pickup and took us back. We got the wheel on the car and got to the gig, like, almost after the gig was over. Much to the anger of our fellow bandmates, but I don't know. It's always a memorable story. Somebody asked me once, they said, did you ever think you were going to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? I thought, well, I remember this time that I was headed to Lubbock. I go, that was not anything that was ever close to being on my mind when I was pushing that tire up the road. Well, probably the most famous story, and it's been told before, but it was one of those moments where, you know, when you asked me about advice to give to players, was when we were beating around town and around Texas playing gigs and, you know, in our van and doing that sort of thing. And we got the opportunity to play at the Montreux Music Festival, and we went, and that's where we met David Bowie and Jackson Browne, which led to the whole Stevie playing on the Let's Dance record and the tapes that we made, because we met Jackson Browne the next evening, and he gave us his studio in L.A. for free to make the tapes that became Texas Flood. Where, you know, I think the important thing in that, it's a fabulous story meeting these people. And you go, you know, like last week we were like in a van headed towards Amarillo, and now I'm like sitting in Switzerland talking to David Bowie and Jackson Browne. And you go, you know, it's that kind of like what people call the overnight success. You know, you've been doing something for years and years, and then you catch a break because you kept doing it and you stuck with it. And so that was kind of a really surreal moment, that whole experience, that happened. You kind of go, what? Really? That's fascinating. Is that how things work? Or maybe not, but it did. So that was interesting. It's always an interesting story to tell. You might be fixing a flat out on the road, and the next week you're hanging out with some guy who says, here, take my studio, and we want, you know, I want you to be on my record, and all these things become a big deal, and you go, wow, that was pretty, it's always been fascinating to me. You know, if you look at any point in two points in time that are right next to one another, and you go, so you never know what might happen. Tommy Shannon and I did a solo record, we called it, a Double Trouble record. We got all these friends and people to come, you know, be the whole rest of the band on all these selections of songs, and so we put the record out and we went touring, and we were doing a thing, Double Trouble, the band, was a group of people. And we were doing a tour with Kenny Wayne Shepherd. And his father was an old friend of James Brown. And so we were going, this tour was going through Augusta, Georgia. And he said, he told me he was a good friend of James Brown. I was like, really? Is that true? So he called him up, he called the phone, and all of a sudden he said, I'll call him right now. And he called him up, and James said, why don't you come by my radio station? We were just around the block at the hotel, and we checked in, and we went over to his radio station, did the buzzer, door opened up, we walk into the lobby. About a minute later, James Brown comes walking around the corner. Met James Brown. He said, what are you boys doing in my town? And we said, well, these guys, we met him, Chris and Tommy, have this record, and we're all touring together. He said, you got a new record? He goes, I want to hear this record. And so we went into his radio station. He told the disc jockey, he said, get up and let Ken, because Ken Shepherd used to be a radio disc jockey, program director, station manager. And he said, Ken, sit down and do what you do best. And so Ken Shepherd got behind the desk and became the DJ, and we played the whole record, and me and Tommy and Kenny and James Brown sat there and we listened to every song, and he interviewed us, asked us questions along with Ken Shepherd about the record. And then when we got done, he said, why don't you let me buy y'all lunch? So we loaded up in his cars and he took us over to his favorite part of town where this restaurant was, and he bought us lunch. We had about a 2-hour lunch with James Brown, sitting talking about anything and everything. And then he drove us to soundcheck because it was time. So I'd spent 11 o'clock from about 11 o'clock in the morning till like 5 o'clock in the afternoon with James Brown. He drove us to soundcheck, and then he sat with his guys. They sat in the first row and listened to our soundcheck, which was a little nervy, but that was kind of one of the most fascinating things that ever happened to me, playing music. Spent a whole day with James Brown. At one point, I tried to ask him a question, and the song was playing. He went, "Shut up, I'm listening to your record." Anyway, it was a priceless day.